Hey everyone, it's Reed. Before we get started, I just want to give you a new way to get in touch with us. podcast@lincolnproject.us. Send us your questions, your comments, your thoughts on our shows, any ideas you might have for guests, or anything else you want to share with us. I hope you'll take advantage of it. Let us know what you're thinking. podcast@lincolnproject.us. And now, on with the show. Welcome back to The Lincoln Project. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Garrett Graff, author, historian, and founding director of the Aspen Institute's cyber initiatives. He's also a contributor to Wired and CNN and has written for many publications, including Esquire, Rolling Stone, and The New York Times, and has edited Washingtonian Magazine and Politico Magazine. As an author, he has a wide-ranging catalog of books, including his latest, Watergate, A New History, which came out earlier this year and is available wherever fine books are sold. Today, he's coming to us from Burlington, Vermont. Garrett, thanks for joining me.
It's my pleasure to chat. A lot to cover this week.
Well, my goodness, is there ever. The reason why we asked you here today is because earlier this week, as we're recording on Monday, the FBI conducted a search of Mar-a-Lago. And this was part of an investigation into the handling of presidential documents, including some that might have been classified. News of the search started to come to light when Donald Trump himself, who was at Trump Tower in New York at the time, released a statement that said, quote, "These are dark times for our nation. As my beautiful home, Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida, is currently under siege, raided, and occupied by a large group of FBI agents. Nothing like this has ever happened to a president of the United States before." Later on in that same statement, Trump went on to say, quote, "They even broke into my safe. What is the difference between this and Watergate, where operatives broke into the Democrat National Committee? Here, in reverse, Democrats broke into the home of the 45th president of the United States." So, Garrett, there's an enormous amount here. So why don't we start with the beginning, which is, why was the FBI there in the first place?
So, Reed, I think it's worth backing up one step from what we know now to what our first thoughts were when the news of the search broke. It is worth remarking on as we consider what a weird moment we are in politically and historically, that when word first came Monday night that the FBI was searching Mar-a-Lago, we didn't know why. And that there were, in fact, literally a half dozen different criminal investigations or criminal conspiracies that are unfolding that we know that various investigative agencies and the federal government and the FBI are interested in that could have been the source of this search.
So sort of like a social club in the Bronx, right? Who knows why they were there? Could have been anything.
Exactly. You start with the challenge and the unprecedented nature of the FBI executing a lawfully authorized search warrant at the home of a former president. I mean, that alone is bonkers and worthy of note. The second is that this is a former president whose apparent criminality is so broad and runs in so many different directions in our modern moment that there were a half dozen different cases that people were speculating about Monday night that this could be tied to. I mean, the January 6th coup, the fake electors scheme, the effort to pressure Georgia election officials, financial improprieties, or this controversy that has been running in the background all year over Trump's handling of classified materials as a former president. And of course, as you well remember, my understanding from the 2016 campaign is that there is no more important issue in America today than the safe and secure handling of classified material. So this is a ultimate irony that 7 years later, here we are, and Donald Trump himself is the one facing questions about his classified material.
Right. And I mean, to your point, I think when the news started breaking, you started to see all of the Fox and all of these folks starting to say, this is unprecedented. Trump even said it. This has never happened before. But I think the parallel to that is what you just described, Garrett, which is we've never had a president, maybe since Nixon, and not even Nixon, who had so many unprecedented things either happen during his campaign, during his presidency, during the end of his presidency, which he did not obviously want to end, or in his post-presidential period. So to your point, the unprecedented nature is a 360-degree deal. Yeah, this might be unprecedented, but this is also a time when these are the kinds of things that happen. Now, we don't put former presidents in jail, right? We're not France. We're not Israel, right? We're not Italy. We're not the state of New York or Illinois or Louisiana, right? Which are constantly sending one governor or another or lieutenant governor or another to prison for various things. So all of this is unprecedented, but I'm interested in the idea that started to leak out too, which not so much from Trump supporters, but from, I guess, folks who would maybe consider themselves the cooler heads, that should the FBI and the Justice Department even undertake such a search, given what that action alone may precipitate amongst Trump's most base supporters?
Exactly. And I think that one of the things that's important to back up and talk through as well here is understanding what getting a search warrant actually means. In this instance, the FBI would have needed to believe a crime had been committed, and they would have needed specific intelligence and knowledge that further evidence of that crime would be uncovered through a search of these premises. You know, federal search warrants are not fishing expeditions. They are not, we don't like Reed Galen, let's toss his house and his office and his car and sort of see if he's up to anything nefarious that we can ferret out by looking through all of his most intimate possessions. This is something where they would have needed to list for a judge, here are the crimes that we believe have been committed. Here's the evidence that we have that these crimes have been committed. Here is the evidence that we have that further evidence of these crimes can be uncovered at this specific address. And in this case, that would have gone to the highest levels of both the FBI and the Justice Department for review and sign off.
And interesting, just as an aside, remember that Merrick Garland, prior to being Attorney General, was a federal judge. So when reviewing this, I assume, Garrett, he might have been the best person in that building in Maine Justice to say whether or not he, with the experience he had, could say this will stand up to scrutiny.
Exactly that. It's also worth noting that in a strange way, Donald Trump would have received sort of two extra benefits of the doubt from previous scandals. The FBI, of course, has been rightly excoriated for its handling of the Carter Page FISA warrant in the 2016 campaign. The Justice Department ultimately decided that two of the four FISA warrants on Carter Page were invalid. The Inspector General issued a 500-page report about how those FISA applications had been misleading and omitted exculpatory evidence, and an FBI lawyer actually ended up pleading guilty to falsifying a document as part of one of those. All of that means that through a series of reforms that have taken place since, and then what was surely work that went above and beyond, you know, the run-of-the-mill search warrants that the FBI processes on a daily basis, all of this evidence would have gotten extra scrutiny inside the Justice Department. And then the other sort of irony in this is, of course, heading back to the 2016 campaign and Hillary Clinton's investigation of her emails, which is the fact that the FBI decided with the Justice Department to not prosecute Hillary Clinton in 2016 actually raises the bar on all future cases about mishandling classified information. As you sort of may remember, you know, the Justice Department is bound by its own prosecutorial precedents. And so part of the challenge with Hillary Clinton in 2016 was the Justice Department had not gone strongly after General David Petraeus when he had mishandled classified information by giving it
to a subordinate who happened to be, it was a personal relationship as well.
Yes, who was both his biographer and his lover. That made it harder for them to prosecute Hillary Clinton in 2016. Not prosecuting Hillary would make it harder now to prosecute someone in similar circumstances. So in a very weird way, even before any of this gets to a judge, Donald Trump would have faced what was probably the highest burden of proof that any search warrant has ever needed in order to get out of the Justice Department.
But to take it back to 2016 for a second, to weave in the political aspect of this, because it was then FBI Director James Comey who released a letter right before the 2016 election, throwing all of the stuff about Clinton back into doubt, and more importantly, maybe even if not in doubt, but it put it back front and center. There's always been a desire, I think, a tradition anywhere, a desired tradition for the Justice Department and FBI, as you said, to be above reproach when it comes to politics. Comey decides to weigh in on it, right? Who knows? We can't prove a negative. We don't know what would have happened. But certainly, you know, if they had it to do over again, they probably would not have dropped a document like that a week before a presidential election, especially with one of the candidates at the source. So now it's one of those things, whether or not it's January 6th, you know, the inappropriate behavior in office, whatever that might mean. And now this illegal documents, which is, we don't want to get involved in politics, but given the nature of all of the things that this man is under the spotlight for, we can't avoid it, no matter how much we want to.
Correct. And I think that that is one of the things that we have seen Merrick Garland already say about his approach to prosecutions, his approach to the prosecutions around January 6th, which is, you know, we will pursue the legal cases and criminal charges, you know, without fear or favor, you know, wherever the facts may lead. Yet at the same time, you have to believe that they were uniquely attuned in this instance to the political ramifications of this particular case, even before that search warrant application left the Justice Department building and went to a magistrate judge in a co-equal and independent branch of government for his own review and his sign off before they could move forward with the search itself.
And the magistrate judge, is that the lowest level of federal judge?
It is a unique role within the federal judiciary. It is the person, among other roles and responsibilities, who signs off on at least the majority of search warrants in normal process.
Okay, got it. So this person is the first step in sort of an ongoing prosecution by the Justice Department, because you've got trial judges, appellate judges, everybody else. So this is their job. So, okay, got it. So let's talk about this, because there's some interesting stuff, too, which was obviously Donald Trump, being the former president of the United States, is a federal protectee. He is protected by the United States Secret Service. They also secure his home. So the FBI, like, probably made a phone call, what, like half an hour before they were coming, be like, hey, by the way, we're going to show up. You should probably let us in. They're not going to say no. And then I guess Trump's attorney is there as well, right? I guess the attorney would be allowed to be on premises while this search is taking place.
Yeah. And remember, the FBI, and you gave the half-joking laundry list of America's favorite corrupt states earlier, but, you know, the FBI has a responsibility in the U.S. system for public corruption cases. And so it actually has a not insignificant experience in investigating people who are under law enforcement protection. The FBI agent who showed up early morning in 2008 at the Illinois governor's mansion to arrest Rod Blagojevich, the first thing they did upon arriving at that mansion was talk to the Illinois state troopers who are guarding that facility and say, all right, you know, we've got a legally authorized warrant for the governor's arrest. What's the best way for us to get into the mansion today? That sort of similar deconfliction appears to have taken place in this case with the Secret Service. Presumably was a very collegial and routine interaction. The FBI gained access to the premises.
As you noted about records, the Secret Service itself, the Department of Homeland Security, the Defense Department, all around on or about or immediately after January 6th, a lot of messages have disappeared. You know, to your point when we first started talking, which was, and look, I was an employee at the White House, right? Like every email you send got an automatic CC to records management. I mean, I was an advanced guy. I never sent an email anybody cared about other than stage height, what the backdrop looked like. That was my email. But they're sitting in the archives somewhere. And explain that a little bit about the National Archives, because I knew what records management was when I worked there. But when I left, I had no further thinking of it. So talk about how the National Archives, which most of us think you go, you visit, you see the Constitution, you see the Declaration of Independence. But what is it that they do behind those glass cases?
Ironically, this all grew out of Nixon and Watergate, which is in the wake of Watergate, Richard Nixon, I'm slightly oversimplifying this story for storytelling purposes, tried to leave with all of his White House tapes and all of his White House papers, you know, declared them his personal property, and he was going to take them home to Yorba Linda. The government, and actually this was a major effort by Sam Ervin, who was the North Carolina senator who actually led the Watergate hearings in the summer of 73, basically said, no, like the documents of a presidency belong to the American people. They established this series of laws and procedures that now basically take the papers of a presidency and deposit them in a distinct federal entity known as the Presidential Library. Those documents over time are organized and sorted and made available to journalists and historians and members of the public.
And there's probably some declassification regimen, so many years, et cetera.
Yes. And there are sort of standard practices where documents are declassified at certain intervals. You can also, as part of archives work, journalists or historians or citizens can show up and ask for what's called mandatory declassification review of a specific document. And you show up and you fill out this form that says, you archivists haven't gotten to this document in this file folder. I can see the name of this file. I'm interested in having you take a special look out of sequence, whether that specific document or file folder can be declassified. And what ends up being funny about this, of course, is, you know, you go to a relatively new presidential library, Clinton or Bush, for instance. I mean, it takes 25 years, 30 years to declassify many documents. So you go to something relatively new like Clinton or Bush 41. And all the files that are out in the presidential library so far are the UFO file, the Kennedy assassination file, Bigfoot sightings. Basically, it's like the things that people FOIA at the first possible moment. And then, you know, if you're actually interested in the Mideast peace talks in the Clinton administration, you know, prepare to wait another 15, 20 years before any of those papers come out.
You know, the archives. Physically, I just have this vision of that big warehouse at the end of Indiana Jones.
Yes. Yeah.
There's boxes and boxes and everything just disappears. But obviously, I assume that so much of recent presidencies also has been digitized. And so it's a much different filing system.
This is actually a really interesting and important point worth considering in the context of this search, which is, you know, this as someone who's worked in government, the government classifies all manner of documents, things that are important and things that are not important, things about allies, things about adversaries, things about intelligence sources and methods. There is a very innocent explanation at the beginning of this saga in January of this year, where maybe some overeager aide in the chaos of moving out of the White House stacked up a couple of file folders in some boxes with personal effects of Donald Trump that were mundane classified documents that as soon as Donald Trump learned this in January, he might have said, oh man, like my bad. I'm so sorry. Like, I'm going to take him down to the UPS store and FedEx him back to, you know, the National Archives in College Park. That's not what appears to have been happening here. And that's what makes this really interesting to me, which is there is something in the documents that Donald Trump has that the US government wants back badly, that it considers truly sensitive, and that Donald Trump doesn't want to give back. And that becomes a really interesting set of questions as you begin to think through the implications of that. If this was Donald Trump was trying to get a jump start on his memoirs that I'm sure he's going to very carefully and thoughtfully write someday for the judgment of thoughtful historians down the road, and, you know, he brought with him some, you know, routine classified documents about exchanges he had on the sidelines of the G7 with Boris Johnson that are, you know, classified at the secret level. The Justice Department's not going to care about that in the way that they did this. If this was an inadvertent set of documents that they took, Donald Trump would have handed them back. Again, not the situation we're facing here. That this is something where these are of a unique sensitivity, where we know, coming back to some of the earlier reporting about these sort of mystery boxes in earlier this year, that at least some of these documents were classified at the top secret level. It sounds like they were actually even classified at what's known as the code word level, you know, sort of SCI, sensitive compartmentalized information, which is sort of a even more restrictive classification.
That's sort of literally like for eyes only. Like if you as a government official or worker don't have a specific need to look at this piece of information, you don't get to see it.
Right. And these might be restricted. One of the reasons that you sort of commonly restrict SCI information is that it's about covert operations or technical capabilities, intelligence sources, you know, intelligence assets that we might have in foreign governments or companies around the world.
And as you remember, even during his presidency, I mean, Trump was a walking, talking national security intelligence threat to the United States. I mean, I remember very roughly, Garrett, that there was a story about something that had happened, maybe it was in Iran, but the only way that anyone could have known that is if Israelis told us.
Yes.
And the Israelis are like, what the hell are you doing? You can't do that. We got people all over Tehran. You can't do this to us.
Yeah. Just to put a very fine point on that story, that was the morning after Jim Comey was fired, when Donald Trump hosted Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in the Oval Office with that like very joking photo.
That was released by a Russian photographer because the official photographer wasn't allowed in.
Exactly. And in that conversation with the leaders of Russia, he told some classified story involving Israeli intelligence.
Which, of course, he just can't help himself.
Right. There's also an example when he tweeted out a U.S. satellite reconnaissance photo of an Iranian facility that under normal circumstances would be among the most highly classified technical capabilities of the United States. And he, you know, literally tweeted it out. Now, as president, that's his right and his ability. One of the nuances of the security classification system is that it all exists for the president of the United States. And so the president can declassify anything that he wants at any time for any reason while president. Most presidents, responsibly, don't do a lot of that. But that ability does not carry forward into him as an ex-president.
And if we can just talk about security for a second, because the president has that right, but he also ultimately had to trump, so to speak, pun intended, the security process for his senior staff, because so many of them, including his own son-in-law, including the Steve Bannons of the world, were incapable of obtaining a security clearance given their background or the fact they wouldn't fill out the information. Garrett, as you recall, I think it was even before he took office that Jared Kushner went to the Russian embassy to make a phone call. Again, as a junior squirrel at the White House, like none of it made sense.
Jared Kushner never was able to get the sort of normal security clearance as a senior White House aide, and basically sort of only got it through the direct intervention of the president, which, again, as president, is his right. And again, the security classification and clearance process exists for the benefit of the president.
Earlier this year, and I want to get to the Watergate comparisons, but I think there's probably more differences. But still, since you wrote a book about it, which I have not read, but I'm very excited to, in February, I think, as you said, someone gets whiffed that this has happened. But there's also, I think, as this morning, I saw a headline, I think maybe out of Newsweek, that someone flipped somewhere along the line in Trump's inner circle to say, oh, you're looking for that? It's in the basement. Now, maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but that seems to be maybe the way that the agents, as they were asking for this, corroborated what they were looking for.
Again, a couple of interesting aspects of this to sort of unpack and walk through. This sort of becomes apparent to the National Archives roughly around the beginning of the year that Trump has additional classified information that he took with him from the White House. The National Archives begins to try to get that back. they ultimately recover through what I would loosely describe as friendly means, about 15 boxes with sensitive material, including at that time at least some information that was top secret or above clearance. Then over the course of the spring, the Justice Department begins to believe that they didn't get it all. And so in June, the head of the counterintelligence and export control section of the National Security Division of the Justice Department goes to Mar-a-Lago with other federal investigators, talks with Trump's team, reviews some set of the documents. Ultimately, it sounds like, you know, had a brief encounter with President Trump himself. And then something happened between then and now that led the FBI to take this much more aggressive step of actually seeking a search warrant to retrieve these documents. That raises the question of what changed that the Justice Department began to believe that basically Trump was lying to them about the documents and that they needed to take this more adversarial step, and that sort of friendlier efforts had failed. And this is the Newsweek reporting from Wednesday morning. They appear to have had some sort of specific human source or confidential informant who was able to provide, again, going back to that search warrant application, the specific intelligence of where and what documents the FBI should be looking for.
They mentioned the basement, but also going back to the quote I read at the top, they even broke into his safe. I assume, Garrett, though I am no safe cracker, although I have watched Heat, that you have to bring some sort of specific equipment to do that. So they knew where they were going to look for this stuff.
Yes. And again, it's worth just stopping here and thinking about what an unprecedented moment this is. You worked in the Bush administration. Imagine John Ashcroft's Justice Department sitting around and coming to believe that they needed to send FBI agents into Clinton's Chappaqua home to retrieve government documents that the Clintons had there. It's unthinkable. Imagine the Obama Justice Department sitting there and saying, all right, well, we need to launch a search warrant on Walker's Point in Kennebunk in order to get back those documents that George W. Bush won't give us that he wants to hold on to. I mean, again, unthinkable. And it goes to show the sort of basic level of corruption and criminality that exists in the Trump ecosystem, that even among this world's most elite club of former American presidents, that the U.S. government can't trust Donald Trump as a former U.S. president.
There was always the leaning towards criminality. There's a fair share of incompetence and I think ignorance, and then just apathy. They just didn't care, right? Like, it's our stuff. Like Nixon originally thought, like, this is my stuff. So let's talk about that. Let me get to the personalities first. In your book, tell us about the sort of mental state of Nixon as all of this is coming down on him. Trump may very well experience this sooner than later if the January 6th committee refers something to the Justice Department, if the Justice Department chooses to pursue this documents matter all the way to, you know, further criminal prosecution. So talk about what a president in your research, who's already probably not well attuned to the outside world to begin with, maybe, starts to experience and how that affects their actions.
This is, to me, one of the most fascinating parallels between Richard Nixon and Donald Trump, which is, and this was a big part of why I wanted to go back and do this book on Watergate and retell Watergate in all of its sort of dirty glory, because we really misunderstand Watergate. And I don't mean we misunderstand Watergate because Donald Trump sort of wrongly cited it in his rambling rant on Monday night. You know, we think of Watergate as beginning with the burglary on June 17th, 1972. You know, the five burglars, John Dean, the Watergate hearings, Woodward, Bernstein, yada, 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 Nixon resigns. And when you go back and you look at what we now understand Watergate to be, It's an umbrella for about a dozen distinct but interrelated scandals that take place in and around the Nixon campaign in 68, then into the Nixon White House and the Nixon administration, right through his resignation in August of 1974. And the one thing that all of the scandals share is they stem from this dark, paranoid, conspiratorial mindset that Richard Nixon brings to politics and brings into the White House. There becomes, when we look at it a half century later now, this very clear line, and I'm not going to sort of go through explaining all of these dozen scandals, but you know, there's this very clear line from Nixon's scandals in the 68 campaign to the Pentagon Papers to ITT and the Dita Beard memo to the dirty tricks of the 72 campaign to Nixon's tax fraud and sort of everything else that unfolds. And it all comes from Richard Nixon's mindset, whether or not he expressly authorizes sort of each of the individual activities, it is all about this dark criminal conspiratorial mindset that he brings into his presidency. And I think looking back now, one of the things that really stands out to me of the last 7 years is that the Donald Trump story is all the same story. You have the Russia investigation in 2016 lead to the Comey firing, to the Mueller investigation, to the obstruction of the Mueller investigation, to the Mueller report, which, you know, leads almost literally the day after into the Zelensky telephone call, leads into the first impeachment, you know, the attempts to sort of undermine his political opponents in the upcoming 2020 election, leads to his attempt to delegitimize the 2020 election, leads to, you know, January 6th, leads to everything else. To me, like, that's all one story, and it comes from the same dark, criminal, paranoid, criminal, conspiratorial mindset that Donald Trump brings from his business life into his presidential life and now into his post-presidency. I don't know what these documents are. I don't know what they involve. I'm going to bet you a dollar that they relate to all of the rest of the scandals of Donald Trump's presidency.
The notes that he took from the interpreter during his meeting in Helsinki.
Exactly. Sort of that type of thing. That there's some reason Donald Trump wants to keep these papers out of the National Archives.
And the paranoia and that paranoic belief from 68 going into 72 was to ensure that Nixon got the candidate they wanted, right, as opposed to the candidate they were afraid of, or the ones they were worried about that they go through. And Trump, the same thing, which was, how do I make sure I stay in power? And ironically enough, if you think about in the spring of 2019, you know, even as an outsider, then you were hearing rumblings that there was something about Joe Biden and Ukraine. Nobody knew what it was. And it very well could have been that sending Rudy Giuliani to Kyiv saved Joe Biden's candidacy, because in that act, it made all the other Democratic candidates surround him, as opposed to if they had thought there was real fodder by themselves, they might have tried to take him out because of it. And so now all of his actions also beget further actions, but also beget his continuing downfall and further travails into criminality.
This is exactly what we saw with Richard Nixon, which is one of the great mysteries for years and decades was, why didn't Nixon just cut G. Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt and the burglars loose and say, I don't really know these guys. They weren't acting with my... Because, by the way, Richard Nixon didn't order the Watergate burglary. He had no apparent knowledge of it before it happened. So we've always wondered, why didn't he hang these guys out to dry? And the answer, as we now understand, is that basically those burglars were involved in so many other criminal conspiracies by that point that sort of the Nixon White House couldn't hang them out to dry without exposing a bunch of other criminal conspiracies. And that I think we see this same pattern in Donald Trump over the last 7 years, you know, over the course of his entire career, where there's so much crime and criminality going on right there that, like, they can't actually effectively combat any single set of charges because you can't pull one thread without unwinding the whole thing.
Well, and that goes back to, we could tie this into the January 6th hearings a little bit too, which is, if you are someone who worked in the West Wing for some amount of time, and you have made the conscious decision to not only testify, you know, behind closed doors to that committee, but in some cases in an open hearing, then there's a pretty good chance that someone, a federal agent, say, might ask you, is there anything else you think we should know about? Who was it that said, I never told anybody about the taping system because nobody ever asked me about it?
Alex Butterfield, yeah.
Alex Butterfield.
I think what we're sort of beginning to see in the broader January 6th hearing, you know, Cassidy Hutchinson surely is of a lot of interest to a lot of different investigators. By the way, like, we haven't even touched on sort of this week's other developments with regard to January 6th and the day after the Mar-a-Lago search. Congressman Scott Perry gets his phone seized by the FBI. Scott Perry, of course, key player in the sort of John Eastman conspiracy to overturn the election, and also someone who asked for a pardon after January 6th, which, again, not to put too fine of a point on it, but I don't know a lot of people who go around asking for presidential pardons who don't have a pretty guilty mind about some crimes that they believe that they committed.
Whether or not it's Perry or all of these other people who asked for pardons, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who asked for one but didn't know how, so she asked the wrong person, right? When it comes down to it, when bad guys are in power and they know they're about to be out of power, they start burning everything they can. Because, Garrett, as you know, even in their heart of hearts, when they believe they are their most powerful, there is that lingering doubt that if I ever get tossed and they find out everything, I'm toast, I'm cooked, and I cannot have that.
And let's remember, Monday started with the reporting and publication by Axios of the White House and presidential toilets clogged with papers that Donald Trump had torn up in violation of the Presidential Records Act.
That's right. And then, you know, as we're recording this today, just earlier today, Donald Trump was called to testimony before Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York, and took the Fifth Amendment. As he said, all Americans have the right to do, which is always the height of irony for me, Garrett, in that so many people who tried to subvert the Constitution are now hiding behind it.
Yeah, which, to be fair, is the right of all American citizens. You know, that's why the Fifth Amendment exists. At the same time, Donald Trump has previously said, who takes the Fifth? The mob takes the Fifth. I don't like people who take the Fifth. And it's worth noting, Hillary Clinton sat through 11 hours of Benghazi public hearings and sat through 3.5 hours with FBI agents about her emails. And the entire Donald Trump story is the story of hypocrisy. But this seems to be an instance where the hypocrisy, to me, is particularly rich.
I want to talk about Secretary Clinton for a second, because as we looked at the coverage of the right-wing media machine, first and foremost, you can always tell when they're most worried because they go to their most outlandish. And the faster they go there, the more worried they are. And they went there in a hurry. And I said this to somebody last night when I was talking to him, Garrett. Hillary Clinton is like the reset button for them, which is, when they don't feel like they have any place else to go, they feel like they've always got fertile ground in attacking Hillary Clinton. But what about Hillary's emails, right? Because they know that of all of the people watching, that's probably the only thing that they can all agree on is that they don't like Hillary Clinton, right? So that's the first place they go. It sort of buys them some time as they come up with whatever craziness they're going to come up with. But then it became 87,000 IRS agents, Nixonian, they can do it to you. They planted things in Mar-a-Lago, which even his attorney, now, I admit that he's probably got to scrape some pretty nasty barrels at this point to find an attorney who will actually represent him, said, well, I don't know if they left anything. And so the problem is that you can never tell the truth. Once you've started in on a carousel of lies like this, it literally can never stop.
We see that particularly clearly in this instance. And I'm also always struck by how little of the defense is ever, we didn't do anything wrong.
No, look, it's like being on a campaign, as you've been on, and seeing terrible polling results come out either publicly or when you get them back from your pollster. And the first instinct is, well, this must be wrong. I mean, what did you do wrong? Or the methodology, you know, they overcompensated for this. They did an oversample on this group, which probably isn't, you know, you don't ever say, well, we're down 14 with 2 weeks to go, right? Like, you never want to say that. But I think that's right, is that it's always a process issue because the facts are rarely ever on their side. As we wrap up here, what do you expect to see as you've looked across the panoply of Trump's troubles here? What do you see between, let's just make it easy, between now and say election day? Do you think he gets in? Do you think Trump-backed candidates or Republican candidates, even some of them that have said some of the craziest things about this, start to try and separate themselves? Because even if it doesn't have a one-to-one effect on a Republican voter or an independent voter, maybe it has a depressive effect. What do you see?
I think it's a good question. And the thing that I always say that is the ultimate challenge from a historian's perspective, we don't know where we are in the Donald Trump story right now. Are we in the beginning, the middle, or the end? Is January 6th going to be looked back on as a turning point for our country, or is it going to be looked back on as the beer hall push, the sort of warning sign that was ignored? That, to me, is the worrisome aspect. If I knew we were in the, I'm mixing my metaphors, you know, if we were in the bottom of the eighth of the Donald Trump story, I'd feel a lot better. There's a very real possibility that we are in the second or third inning of the Donald Trump story. Something big feels like it happened on Monday. I don't know in which direction.
Well, and to your point, of all of those people who were initially riled up about 2020 and it being stolen from Donald Trump, thousands of whom came to Washington, D.C., hundreds of whom stormed the Capitol, many of whom will go to federal prison, who are willing to commit violence. Has that universe grown? Has it grown in extremity? Has it grown in virulence? I was reading one of the NBC misinformation, disinformation reporters saying, you know, because they spend all day on these horrific chat sites, 4chan, 8chan, I can't even imagine spending time there, that like the calls to violence and civil war had been, they hadn't seen that sort of volume since January 5th. And so where are we now? As his desperation increases, does their desperation increase correspondingly?
You're absolutely right there, because that really is the big question to me. One of the challenges that I think is worth really thinking about, we have never really seen Donald Trump backed into a corner. We have seen him lose. We have seen him escape some pretty close calls. We have never actually seen him face a truly existential moment. I certainly can't believe that Donald Trump gets more responsible and more respectful of our democracy and our institutions the more cornered he gets.
This is one thing, talking to somebody the other night who is in a position to sort of really understand his mental state, and said vulnerability is not allowed in his brain. Invulnerability is the only state he's ever really known. Vulnerability was not tolerated in the family. He's invulnerable, but now, Garrett, as you see with the stories out today, he's not only invulnerable, he's alone. Who can he trust? Jared and Ivanka say they're gone. A lot of the quote-unquote normals, who are normal only in the universe of Donald Trump, they've already been under oath. They don't want to go to prison for this guy. And he will find new lackeys, because these guys always find new lackeys. But to your point, he will always react badly. And we've seen that. We've caused that, frankly, as an organization. But I think that's absolutely the right question, is as he becomes more vulnerable and more isolated, what is the result of that? I pray for all of us that maybe he decides he doesn't want to be president again. Maybe he decides he doesn't want to run for president again. But I don't see that happening. All right, well, Garrett, before we let you get out of here, where can our listeners find you online?
So I am VermontGMG on Twitter and GarrettGraff.com. And you can, as you said at the beginning, find Watergate, A New History, wherever you prefer to buy your books, however you prefer to buy them.
Awesome. And as always, gang, you can find me on Twitter at Reed Galen and on Instagram at Reed_Galen_LP. Garrett Graff, thank you for joining me today. And everyone else, we'll see you next time. Thanks again to everyone for listening. be sure to follow and subscribe to The Lincoln Project on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or however you listen. Don't forget to leave a 5-star review. To connect with us, follow us on Twitter at Project Lincoln, and for more information on our movement, to join our mailing list, subscribe to our newsletter, or make a contribution to our efforts, visit lincolnproject.us. Also, be sure to check out our LPTV lineup, including The Breakdown with Tara Setmayer and Rick Wilson, which airs Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, as well as We're Speaking with Lisa Senecal and Maya May, which airs Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern. All shows you can stream live on the Lincoln Project's YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter pages. And we'd love you to join us for our newest show, Lunch with Lincoln, which airs every Friday at noon Eastern on our YouTube channel. For the Lincoln Project, I'm Reed Galen. See you on the next episode.